Okay, to get started, let's talk about the soul before we get to prayer. First of all, in terms of finding the relationship of the soul and God, we'll have three broad approaches. One of them is that God is as near as your own heart, that one looks inside and contemplates from oneself and finds the divine. The second one is that one is a microcosm of the divine, Tzelem Elohim, and we have the same structure.
The soul.
And three, there's a ladder of ascension, a Sulam Yaakov, in which we ascend. Kabbalah weaves back and forth between all three of them. So we've seen passages already that who is enlightened? Those who find God by themselves, within themselves, and therefore by one's looking within oneself, one finds Malchut, and then from there to the higher Sefirot. We've seen various forms of Kigavna. However we are above, below, we are up above, and there's a parallelism. And the third model of a Sulam Yaakov, if there's a clear ladder one ascends, is the approach of the Sharei Ara. Now Maimonideans tend to prefer the third and tend to reject the first two, because Maimonides, first, number one, is finding God within is more of a Neoplatonic trope than an Aristotelian one. The idea of finding a microcosm of the divine within you is openly rejected by the Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim. The macrocosm is rejected by the Moreh Nevuchim. Someone like Chikatilo will not use it. Well, ladder of ascension is the only one therefore left open as a model for Chikatilo. Chikatilo will use Tzelem Elohim microcosm, but only about our chachma, the way the Rambam would. We are Tzelem Elohim in terms of having the same chachma. Yes.
Is it just
It's on a philosophical ground. Is they would say that the divine is only known as a final causality of wisdom, can never be known as the material cause within anything. Immanence within the physical, the sort of Hasidic late makom matzponumine, would not be acceptable for Jikatila. Now let's go to talk about soul specifically.
Yeah. When you say that the divine is final totality,
I was answering his question in terms of that there's a real philosophic issue that someone like Sharei Ora would reject a lot of the approach of Chassidut.
I hear so what was the divine goal?
I don't know, I didn't use the word.
Can you say the divine is final causality?
No. Final causality.
Okay.
Now, in order to present the Kabbalistic views on the soul, I have to start with the medieval philosophers on the soul. For the word soul, anima, means what something that keeps you vital. It's not the way we use soul in English today. For the medieval philosophers, there was a vegetable, an animal, and a rational soul. Your vegetable soul is in charge of digestion. Your animal soul is in charge of locomotion and instinct and emotions, while your rational soul was your ability to think. And the higher up you went, it's the more capabilities you have. Today we would tend to present this as levels of... in modern English we tend to use it in terms of your brain structure.
Cortex,
right. The levels of your brain, there are basic ones. there are then the more higher ones, and there's the irrational capabilities. Within the writings of Moshe De Leon, who writes quite a bit about the neshama, he lumps all three of the souls of the philosophers into one category called the nefesh. Higher than that is a category called ruach, which includes emotions, ethics, volition. Because emotions, the way this is already the way we use ruach in the modern sense. Oh, the Shabbaton had a lot of ruach. It doesn't mean the animal passions. It means that there's some sort of enthusiasm that you transcended your normal self. And neshama is an acquired mystical level from Moshe De Leon's writings. So your rationality is nefesh. Your ruach is very closer to the way we use the word for enthusiasm today. And neshama is an acquired level. Within the Zohar, nefesh is your base. Yes.
For De Leon, is neshama like Mister?
No, it's acquired through doing things correctly and raising yourself up levels. Okay, in the Zohar, nefesh is your basic life force. We're all born with it. It's identified with malchut. Ruach is Torah, mitzvot, tefillah, identified with tferet. Neshama connects you up to Bina, and it's something acquired that one has to work on. If we tie this back into our fourfold scheme we opened up the course with, we had garment, body, soul, and soul of souls. We all have a nefesh. The body is doing Torah umitzvot, tferet. The goal is to reach neshama, and neshama lets you get up to neshama of neshama.
In this case, it's bina.
No, bina gets you, can get you up to keter. Okay. Now, hold questions while I now explain where this went. In the 16th century, and this is the language that we use until the 20th century, Chaim Vital in his Shari Kedusha distinguishes between a nefesh elokut, a divine soul, and a nefesh habahamit, or a nefesh tivit, an animal soul, or a natural soul. This dichotomy will then be used by almost everyone afterwards, 18th, 19th century. Both Tanya and the Nefesh HaChayim talk about Nefesh Elokut and Nefesh HaBahamit. Talk about both of them. And that you have a struggle between this dualism. The goal is now to fight these two aspects within you. It certainly is, but the Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer HaTov, and it's really a Kabbalistic rereading of that. But it now becomes grafted onto a higher dimension, in which in the Chaim Vital scheme of things, there are now not three souls, but five souls. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and Yechidot. Yechidah. What? It's in the Sfat writings, and it seems to be... Sure. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and Yechida. Okay?
You're saying that...
Please, could everyone stop calling out? It is very hard to teach. I'll ask questions between sections, not in the middle of sections. These two higher levels, Chayah becomes now reaching the higher realms, while Yechidah becomes mystical union. And let me explain this by jumping to the 18th century. For the Vilna Gaon, Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, you acquire yourselves. While the higher two, so Neiran, Nun Resh Nun, Neiran, you acquire yourselves. But Chai, the higher two levels are a grace or an influx, a form of nevuah or something that comes down to you from above for those who are worthy. Okay, there are many Sephardi Mekubalim who will treat it the same way. Three levels up, and the higher two levels are special gifts. Most Hasidic texts assume that you can do all five levels on your own. And where this really becomes the Ari is when these things become multiplied, is that you have, we'll see, every soul multiplied 5 times 5, and you have each of these souls in all 10 spherot, and it becomes multiplied out to hundreds of levels to your soul, which we're going to come back to in a few minutes. But just like I said, hold your questions. In the 17th century, in Italy, under early modern influences, these five levels of soul become 24 levels of soul. Now, this is not all going to be original. A lot of these are already in the Ramak, in the Shar HaNeshama, but they're now going to be treated as a real chart in which, and listen to this, you're going to be a psychosomatic whole in which you're going to have one soul that is seen as the, comes to you at conception, another soul that is seen as the form of your body, another soul that is your nervous system. You're going to have Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, each one being able to be multiplied 3 times 3 to make 9 levels. You're going to have at least 3 auras and astral bodies around you. Hence the idea, various ideas of ghosts and projecting auras. And altogether, it's about 24. So that's why in the 17th century, the great Baroque era, that was the era that you don't, it's called Baroque because you keep multiplying out variables. But also, there's a blurring of the lines in the 17th century between some of these which we now know as physical terms, like the nervous system, the Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, which is our more traditional Kabbalah, and now these auras and astral bodies, which have their own equal lives from elsewhere in terms of the lights of the soul. This 17th century scheme, when it becomes simplified in its 18th, 19th century, becomes our English word soul, as some sort of religious quality you have beyond materialism. So I did this the long version so we don't trip on our language. For the Rambam or the philosophers, the Rambam and Shmona Parakim, your 3 neshamot are animal forces, your vegetable, your animal, your rational. The Kabbalists, the Zohar, and this is to understand, put all of those qualities within your nefesh, make ruach, most of what we call spirituality today, and say neshama is a higher acquired, state of illumination. 16th century Tzfat adds two higher states of illumination, the high that's even higher. 16th, 17th century multiply out, I mean, we'll collect all the various physical and spiritual souls and energies and qualities to speak about a person and create a huge tablet of them. And then we have an English word soul, which remains now as a short summary of saying, oh, we still have some sort of soul and we're not just materialist, but that word soul can now refer to almost anything. And certainly in, you know, William James, it can mean almost anything beyond the complete chemical, physical. Now I'll take some questions on everything but Gilgul, which is my next topic. Yes?
Do you think that the Chaim Tal was responding to a lack of there being Chacham and Keter within those three levels? And a Tzfat desire to go higher than Bina?
Do I think? I think that that's one element. I think it also corresponds to the five Partsufim. I think it corresponds to the Chaim Vital and the Ari having Arach Anpin ever inaccessible, and therefore there's some sort of higher state that's beyond our normal Zer Anpin and Nukva. I mean, I've never thought about it. I mean, I think there's more than one reason for why they're doing it.
And who are these Barakeh 17th century Kabbalists?
I mean, the best example is the Menachem Azariah Fano. Go read his Ma'amar HaNefesh in Asara Ma'amarot, and it will be entirely about the soul.
Is it Italy?
In Italy. Yes.
So how did the Rambam explain this?
Or Maimonides?
Yeah.
As a philosopher?
Yeah.
It is your acquired intellect.
So everything, there's no like part of the Shem for him?
I mean, like, your acquired intellect, because God created everything with wisdom, your acquisition of wisdom is now partaking of the divine wisdom. The divine wisdom is seen as, the wisdom all around us is seen as part of the divine. But it's not. There's nothing emotional or enthusiastic or what we would call spiritual about it. For Maimonides, it's contemplative knowing of the knowledge of the universe, the knowledge of the divine. And if you're not very smart, you also therefore have no soul, if any. Okay, it's a very non-PC approach. Yes?
Well, in Mishnah Torah, Rambam mentions a lot about getting all emotional and loving about God.
Because that will motivate the intellect. It is an intellect driven by eros. So if you think of Hilchot Tshuva, Perek Yud, Halacha Dalet, it is an intellect driven by eros. Because you still need the motivation, but the motivation does not take on a life of its own. Okay? Beyond this course, if we were doing medieval Maimonideanism, a Maimonidean-like Hillel of Verona in Italy will incorporate that emotion and that imagination. Because the Rambam will also speak about the koach hamedameh needed for a Navi. So that volition, eros, and imagination will be reincorporated within to the soul for Hillel of Verona. Okay? That's a technical point. Or to put it in a other way, Maimonides' more Farabi roots do not do that. And in a post-Avicenna world, I mean, Avicenna came first, but in using now Avicenna rather than Farabi, Maimonideans can open up that category. But Maimonides himself did not. Gilgul. Okay? Basic concept, Gilgal.
I don't know
what I'm doing. Is... I guess I was waiting for someone to jump up and say something interesting. Sadyagon and Yehuda Halevi and the Kuzari both reject the concept of Gilgal, but they know that a lot of Jews accepted it. We know from Karaite literature and patristic literature that many Jews in late antiquity held from Gilgal, but philosophers rejected it. Time we get to the Rambam, there's not even a need to mention it anymore because it's an assumption that philosophers rejected. The first to openly defend Gilgal in Judaism is the Ramban. The Ramban, using Sefer Bahir, where Sefer Bahir says Dor Shehalechu Hador Shaba. Ramban reads that as an affirmation of Gilgal. It is not the only way to read the Bahir, because Dor Shehalechu Hador Shaba could also mean that all souls come from Bina and return to Bina, which is the reading that it got in the circle of the Rashba commentary that's printed. Ramban will then use it many places. Ramban says that the secret of Yibum is Gilgal, and that's why it's needed. And when you look at the Ramban Al Torah on Yehuda and Tamar, he will explain that's the secret of Yehuda and Tamar. It's the secret of Rut, that the soul of the dead husband needs to come back. More than that, if you read the introduction of the Ramban to Eov, what is the true answer of Tzadik Faralo for the Ramban? Gilgal. That either it's paying back for the past, or you will work it out in a future life. So rather than these rather modern presentations of the Ramban we tend to hear today, the Ramban himself thought the answer to human life and meaning was reincarnation. This Ramban writing this in the 1260s will be continued to debate it in the first decades of the 14th century, usually in the form of a question. So, if you believe in Gilgal, when you die, which comes first? You're going to Gehenna or you're going to Gilgal? Do you first have punishment for your sins and then come back? Or do you then come back and then have a punishment after you're done coming back? For Rabbeinu Bechaya Al HaTorah, a student of the Rashba, who had many Ashkenaz mystical traditions that first show up in his writings, he says, after you die, you first go to Gehenna, then you are purified, and then you have Gilgal. Because Gilgal is limited to extreme cases of Yibum and Tzadik Viralo, that the soul still had to accomplish something or to be paid back.
Infrequently, right?
Infrequently. An alternate answer is from the Raya Mehemna, part of the Zohar corpus. Probably from the first decade of the 14th century, says that yes, Gilgal is for extreme cases. So if your life becomes short, you immediately come back to life, and then you have Gehenna after you're done coming back. As the 14th century goes on, And bear in mind, most scholarship of the 13th century has been written in the last 30 years. We're just beginning to turn to the 14th and 15th centuries in terms of scholarship. There are a number of 14th century texts which now make Gilgul universal. One of them is the anonymous Sod HaShaleach. Another is the anonymous Masoret HaBrit. In both of those books, Gilgul is universal. Not only do special cases come back, but rocks, plants, animals, all people, Jew and non-Jew, angels, are forever being reincarnated with their soul energies. These in the 14th century were not mainstream opinions. The coming back only for rare cases was the mainstream opinion. Until we get to the 16th century. Okay, there's lots of other opinions floating out there between the 13th and the 16th century. There are a few books out there that have collected them. But let's now turn to the 16th century. Within Svat, Gilgul is now seen as universal. The basic opinion accepted by all, and when I mean Svat, I mean 16th century, 16th century post-Geirish Svarad culture, whether it's in Greece, Turkey, Italy, North Africa, Egypt, Svat, or Damascus. Svat is just a shorthand for saying a type of spirituality. So within Safed spirituality, the mainstream opinion accepted by all, before we get to the new opinions, is the one of Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Beit Yosef, the Baal Halacha, who says that everybody comes back twice. Some people come back three times. You'll have many variants of that floating around. I cite that one because since it's Yosef Karo, that one becomes a mainstream. We've got a lot to accomplish. The day is short. So you have to come back at least once to get what you want to accomplish done. In the Magid Mesharim. Okay, many places in there.
Does this time count?
I can't hear.
You said everyone comes back twice. Two more times or one more
time? One more time, some people two more times. What? Okay. And there's lots of little variants of that. I cite that one as a just general typifying the age. But now I want to turn to Gilgul within the array. Because this one is a real major change, no questions till I'm done with it, because I hear so much nonsense on this one that you've got to get this straight. For the Ari, as interpreted by Chaim Vital, Adam HaRishon, Adam was one big soul. Which after Chet Adam HaRishon was broken down into 600,000 souls. Those 600,000 souls each have a part of a Nefesh Ruach Neshama Chia Yechidut, meaning each one of them are five, giving us 3 million. Each of those things also exists within five Partsufim. Giving us 15 million. Each of them exists within each of the 10 Sfirot, and each of the 10 Sfirot are made up of 10 Sfirot. Go multiply that out. We are now up to 1.5 billion. And the way it works is a person can have a malchut of keter, of a neshama, of chia, of a specific soul of, let's say, kalev, while a different part, their ruach from their netzach of yesod within zer anpin can come from sarach bar asher, meaning anything can be spread out. So we are all made up of many, many different soul parts. It's like a long DNA chain. If, you know, each one of us, if all of our souls have five parts sufim, and each one is made up of 100 spherot, and there's a five parts to each one, there are hundreds of thousands of parts to a soul. So it's not that there's no one correspondence. You are not a reincarnation of Rabbi Akiva or Acher or anybody else. There is a certain amount of soul energy that comes from many sources. Now, after the sin of Adam HaRishon, and which was a catastrophe in the universe, a major shvira, whenever somebody is born, during their life, they will perfect a certain amount of parts of their soul. When those parts that are perfected are perfected, those that are not perfected go thrown back into the hopper and are recombined to create a new person. So there is no personal identity in this form of reincarnation. Okay? A lot of times, you know, people go from one extreme to the other. You'll find a YU person who goes from not believing in reincarnation to then having a very wrong opinion, as if there's personal identity involved. There is no personal identity involved in the Ari's Gilgul. It is entirely energy going into a soul hopper. And our goal is to rectify all the parts of our soul. No questions yet. Luria's claim to fame is that when he showed up in Yerushalayim and Svat, he could read your forehead, your auras, your palms, and let you know all the parts of your soul and what tikkunim they need. Now this scheme also has various quirks and inversions to it. For example, much of Kayan's energies came back as Moshe. But sometimes if you sin, you will come back as an animal. Okay, it's not all limited with the human realm. Your base parts, your animalistic parts can come back as a black dog or some other creature. There is also the idea of ibur, of some sort of temporary impregnation of soul energy from another person. So the way we use the language of inspiration or connection to someone that died, the sense that you have a temporary ibur, you are channeling that person, you have some quality with that person. Talmidei Chachamim all have Iburim from scholars that have died. One final distinction. Where most Sefer Kabbalah assumes that everybody has Gilgul, the Ari held that women and non-Jews do not have souls, except in rare special cases. Hold on. And that's a big one because, you know, that offends many people's sensibilities or they just want to pretend that one's not there. But for the Ari, it is only Jewish men who have souls, except if a woman is a man. And that creates all sorts of inversions about what somebody is and if a woman does have a male soul, etc. Now I'll take a brief round of questions. Yes. Yes.
Do women just not have neshamas or not even nefesh or differentiate?
They have no, they're not part of this system. Period.
What does that mean?
Must I draw the implications of this? Life, I mean, animal life force, they have, you know, so do... They have to have more of the philosophic parts, but they're not part of this philosophic system.
So what is... There's no, like, shechina representation of, like what are women...
So that we talked about. Review your notes for the midterm for my belief class number 3. For the Ramak, everything is male, female, male, female, male, female. Chachma, Bina, Tferet, Malchut, husband, wife. For the Ari, Nukva needs to ascend into Zeranpin. Kabbalists are really relating to Zeranpin. Nukva Malchut really disappears in his system. It really becomes everything being raised up. So where Gershom Shalom emphasizes the independence of the Shechina and Nukva with whatever Jungian reasons he wants to do that, of anima, and plays that up. Elliot Wolfson from NYU does the opposite, and rather than citing Cordovero text, will cite Chaim Vital and Ari text about the feminine being entirely submerged and reintegrated within the male. Yes? Susie Schneider has a wonderful book from the Rova in Israel about, she uses the Leshem, a late Misnagei Kabbalistic work that has yet to be fully studied for all the layers within that book, about the growth of Nukva into higher forms. She uses prior things, but it will not work using Chaim Vital. She works backward. It works backwards from late. It works backwards from late. More of a Shemesh from the Leshem and other later works working backwards. It doesn't work forward. Yes.
The Ramban talks about Gilgul. Is reincarnation a direct translation of Gilgul?
Say it again.
For the Ramban, would reincarnation be a perfect translation?
No. No. For the Ramban, Gilgul would mean it would be rebirth. A special rebirth would be the Ramban's translation. The idea of reincarnation.
I feel like reincarnation, you have this concept where, like, one soul intact, like, leaves a body and then intact comes back.
Okay, that is more of Yosef Karo.
So is the Ramban more like the.
No, here the Ramban is saying it's only for special cases. I mean, that's the point. But the Ari is not what most Americans call reincarnation, and I find that you know ever irks me. Get this straight. The Ari also assumes that children have nothing to do with their parents. Because since we're all energy from the soul hopper, if you have parts of the soul, you're taking them. You can't be giving them anything to your children. Where DNA, we think, goes to the children passed down, you're using all parts of your soul. Your children's souls come from the hopper. They don't come from you. I mean, there's a lot of things in his theory that are very not the way we think, very not contemporary spirituality. Yes?
You said that it was believed in many Jewish
inner circles in late antiquity that this idea of guilt will exist, but before that, is this coming from Greek? Is this coming from Pythagoras? Or
reincarnation?
Yeah.
Reincarnation goes back to antiquity in most cultures. The early, like I said, that's the problem. We don't have any, it's not in the Gemara, it's not in Tanakh. Every critic of Judaism in late antiquity assumed Jews held it. But beyond that, our first place, that we only have negative statements about it until it crops up in the Ramban.
That can be interpreted
that way. Right, but the first one that must be interpreted that way is the Ramban. Yes.
Sorry, just a quick question. So, where did they make this statement about women and non-Jews?
If it's not chapter 1 or 2, it's chapter 3. Very beginning of Shaar Gilgulim.
Shaar Gilgulim.
Yeah, very beginning. The opening words of either chapter 2 or chapter 3. I mean, I haven't looked recently.
And also, based on this approach to women, how would they re-understand women who are supposedly are Nevi'im?
They're men.
Oh, in reality, really, they have a Neshama, because they're...
Yeah.
All right.
When she says, "I want to go to," like even when Dvorah says, "I want to go to war," because then they'll say the woman won. And
yeah.
She's clearly a woman.
So
her
neshama is the neshama of a man, or she? Again, I just want to be sure. I'm not trying to be facetious. I don't understand.
Yes, in some way she.
Not identifying obviously woman by.
In one of his later chapters, not the beginning, but I forgot what chapter. Lamed something. When somebody's tucked away, he then gives like half a dozen cases where women do have souls.
And which means by definition it must be a man.
Meaning have the soul, right? Meaning either because they're really men and they have to come back. For example, they were completely non-given in life and they've got to experience this mode, or because they have to complement and serve some sort of role. I mean, he gives a number of reasons why these things occur. Yes.
So does Re have the own half and face amazing into the system?
Does he?
So what happens in case of amazing point this whole?
Then there are these ideal figures that come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd probably be better off with the Ramban where you come back as you and you're with your own as you are, with the Ramban and Shaar HaGemul. So the Ari is really not our ideas of person. We like personal identity. We're very much in the self and our personalities in a way that a lot of Tzfat was much less interested. They really wanted to give up the self and get beyond the self. Okay? Which is a real major difference. Yes?
Another question. What was the objection that all the philosophers had against reincarnation? Why did they reject reincarnation?
Each one has their reasons. I don't know anyone who's culled it all out. But then already you have more qualified. In Crestus and Albo, you now have more qualified. We accept it because we know some people accept it. We don't know. Yes?
Based on the idea, again, that we're all just made up of random parts, like a Frankenstein, basically, it's a sound like when I heard that. So when the Torah says, for example, you do a certain there,
For those parts.
Those parts go back. Get thrown back into the guiltful.
Yeah. That's right. They are unredeemable.
I mean, once something's redeemed, it doesn't come back again to be dirty.
That's right.
So you will only get it back.
Except as various ebors.
And so again, so how would you read, like, understand? Again, I know it's a different system.
Yeah.
Assuming, like, you know, kind of corrupt that thing, but assuming. They're fixed with the Gemara or Mishnah, you know, Alan Devil involved me and him, it dislocates Jogul, as opposed to, I'm trying to understand, I'm assuming that there's systematic.
Yes.
It'll work.
Yes.
We can synthesize it with the Mishnah. So how would Ari read, for example, that Mishnah of Alan Devil Mabah?
It means that those parts are going to be cut off and unredeemable and are going to need special tikkunim.
Okay.
Yes.
Do we have divots in the system?
That's the next point I want to get to. Magidim and Zibukim.
And
No, Shadim are different.
Okay.
You're going to ask me about that afterwards. All right, so it's just side points. Shadim and Marzikim are a whole bunch of categories of separate things having nothing to do with Kabbalah, but know that Rav Papa Shade was some sort of little hobbit of some sort, you know, leprechaun, completely different than a Mazik, which is some sort of energy. I mean, in the history of these things are different, but that's not traveling with Kabbalah. That's seen as its own separate realm. Sometimes it crosses into it, sometimes it doesn't. But there are lots of these little things that are out there, even in the Gemara, to shade them of all different types and cultures. I'm not going there. We're not getting off the board into this discussion.
I don't
know if
people are
interested. What?
Yeah.
Let's deal now with Magidim and Dibukim. First, Magidim. From the 16th century on, there is a sense that there, you can have angelic visitors, or you can have past teachers come to you, not just as a non-conscious Ebor, but as actually somebody who you meet and you speak to. Famous cases include Rav Yosef Karo, who would meet a Magid, who would either be the Shechina or the spirit of Tana and the Mishnah. It would include the Ari, it would include Ibn Makir, it would include the Ramchal, the Vilna Gaon, all had Magidim. And anyway, within this is a taking something of what we've just said that was internalized and externalizing it as a separate quality that will teach somebody something. Separate than that are spirits and dibukim. Rav Chaim Vital, besides recording the Ari's Kabbalah, also had a bunch of women followers, one of whom, Bat Raphael, became possessed by a spirit and was then channeling. She then started channeling the dead scholar Pizzo, who infested this woman, and Chaim Vital had to do an exorcism for his student, this woman. The 16th and 17th century will now have a greater sense of spirit possession and dibukim, closer to what we now know as spirit possession and exorcisms. Separate than that is an Eastern European folk culture in the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. There is seen as the idea that you can be possessed by somebody else with their full personal identity coming back within you. So where the 16th century, the spirit possession that needs an exorcism, or a small part of a scholar's energy will go to another scholar, in, let's say, 19th and 20th century Eastern Europe, there's a sense that, for example, your uncle could then possess, you know, could possess you and not want to, your uncle Jaime could come and want to possess you and not want to leave you unless some great act is done. And that is its own separate variable having more to do with Ashkenaz and Ashkenaz thought in the 17th to 20th centuries than technical Kabbalah. Questions? Yes?
When you have that cryptic comment in the Ravid saying the Rambam was wrong because somebody came down from the basement and told him.
Yes.
Is that the same?
That's a form of Nevuah. In Provençals, many Provençals believe in some form of Nevuah. Gershon Shalom and the Origins of Kabbalah has a nice chapter dealing with all these figures that did. Also, the Reuven Margolio's Introduction to Shoot Min HaShemayim deals with all these rabbinic figures in the 11th, 12th, 13th century that had visitors. Many angelic visitors go back to the Bible. You know, unlike Gilgul, having visited by an angel is a very traditional Jewish concept. Okay, but know that Professor Tversky in his book on the Ravid downplays and doesn't take that seriously.
He means his father-in-law.
Yeah, for a variety of modern Orthodox halachic reasons, really downplays.
Call your father Hashem
Elokim. Hmm?
Say you call your father.
Yeah, because there is that blurring of the lines in these presentations, and you'll see it. For example, you read on something people read the Magidim that come to the Ramchal, and he also will blur the line between Tanayim visiting him and the Shekhinah visiting him, as if it's Hainu Hach. That there clearly was a sense that angel equals Shekhinah equals the spirit of the Tana. In a way that we don't appreciate the experience anymore. Yes?
So what do you make of this? All these Makina
and Halachos that come out from
these? Which were, those are two separate. What do I make about it? It was clearly, the Makina was clearly a phenomena that all great scholars from 1530 to about 1830 had to have a Magid. I mean, even though the last one we have a full account of, serious account of, is the Gra. The Chassam Sofer is credited with the Magid, because how can he not? He's a Gadol. When you have figures like Rav Yehuda Fataya, the Mekubal, having one in Yerushalayim 80 years ago, that's already seen as, even though that's already seen as different than our current stream, but it's not our current construct of personality and soul.
Did these people claim that they did, or it was like some folk thing that
they did? No, they claim they did in the first person. As real as we say I dreamed something last night, as real as we say I ate something for dinner last night, I don't discount it at all, but it doesn't fit into our constructions of personality. And with these things, those things matter quite a bit.
How do you understand that? How do you understand that? You don't do call it really going with mythological.
No, I do believe there's a real experience there. That we in our quest for individualism of personality have clearly have really curtailed its possibility. Because part of it is to not own your unconscious is basically saying there's another force. There are books taking us beyond this course that deal with it. If we're taking it out of the Jewish and the broader cultural context, is how these ideas disappeared in the 19th and early 20th century. How that was originally in the 18th century, you could still say you had a force acting through you, whether angel, magid, or divine Holy Spirit if you were a Christian, how in the 19th century you had a greater sense that we live by our conscience, and even our unconscious is owned by us. A moment in the beginning of the 20th century when people still could have ghosts, possessions, we have such a strong sense of conscience. We don't let go. We don't allow the possibility of Magidim anymore. But we do have exorcisms are back in, both in Christian culture in America and Jewish culture in Israel. Exorcisms are back.
Mm-hmm.
where most of the 20th century problems were all internalized and you had to own your problem as if it belonged to you and it was a character fault or part of your personality. So either you have bad character or you are going to fail some personality test that's going to be given to you, and then therefore we have to give you some sort of medication to take care of it. In the last 20 to 25 years, there is now a return to the externalization of problems, and that the only way to overcome vice is now to externalize it and to have an exorcism. So Christian exorcism is now in America, and there is a wonderful book by Michael Cuno talking about the process. And that was already a decade ago, and there's much that's gone on since that point. And there's the Israeli press will keep up. There is now regular exorcisms that go on in Israel. The one that occurred that was broadcast in Eretz Sheva 5 years ago was phony, it turned out. It was phony, but already people wanted to externalize. There really was a sense that modernity was not going to answer all problems, but there are a lot of minor cases that are going on now that are not phony, that really do occur.
How can you tell it's phony?
Because that one was staged. Yeah. People do believe them. That is a case we're seeing before our own eyes. I mean, to give you a case about why I'm believing Magidim, is before our own eyes that in 1970, if you had a problem, you either you had to go see a psychiatrist, or by the late 80s we could give you Haldol to sedate you. By the 90s, even though we have ever greater form of sedating, we have less of a sense of owning it. Therapy is less in. Talking is less in. It's less linked to your childhood and could now be personified as something external to you. More and more people are looking for a freedom from the self, a giving up of the self, in a way that from Kantian autonomy in the 1770s on has not been seen as popular. Well, there's a Musser book that's now out, a little anonymous book, what's it called? Bovavi Mishkan Evne, little pamphlet that everyone's reading, that its opening page is basically saying you are not a self, you are not an individual, give yourself up to the system, give yourself up completely. It was really 200 years no one would say a statement like that.
Self or ego self?
Huh? You're giving up beyond just ego self. You're giving up much more. So, I mean, as much as we're watching a trend, and this I'm going to get back to tefillah, as much as we watch the trend for individualists to go turn to the Gra and the Kutzker and the Ishbitzer and Rav Kook, all the great seekers of individualism and personal autonomy and personal self, we're now in the last 20 years begun to watch books that are now going to be the start of something new, the relinquishing of the self and the identifying with something bigger. Bilvavi Mishkan Evne for now is being read, okay, you read it, you gloss it over. I can easily see 50 years in the parts that don't make sense 50 years from now when it now becomes, you know, whole schools of now saying, of course we have no individual identity.
Well, Wilbur just really differentiates between certain people like giving their self up to like pre-egoic like nature, you know, like our society states, and then like
okay. So the answer is I can see there's both going to be both a pre and a post going on here. For some people this is regressionatory. For some people, for the Tzfat, if you are aspiring to a Magid like the Gra or the Ramchal, that is a post. That is a higher state. That you've now gone to that prophetic level.
Same as genetic explanations of all sorts of traits that a person has.
Okay. Now let me get on to what time we have left. We have about 10 minutes of prayer. Okay. Be glad this wasn't a larger class, or we would have never gotten out of this topic. thought this enough times. With, you know, I'm sitting here saying, okay, how far afield is this class going to get? But it's important for the sequence of getting things out there. Let's get on now to tefillah. Now that we have a little neshama, let's get on to tefillah. Tefillah has many levels within Kabbalah. And I want to get out at least 4 points before we break. The first point, Kabbalah accepts the love and will of the heart, the Re'uta Deliba, that's found in Bachya ibn Pakuda's Chavot Levavot and Yehuda Halevi's Kuzare. The idea that prayer is a giving up of the heart and a devotion of the self. Kabbalah also accepts the philosophic idea of Rikuz Machshava from the Aristotelians. Number two. Rikuz Machshava, a focusing of the thought. And for the second category, the Rikuz Machshava, Arye Kaplan tried explaining it decades ago, but did not get his point across too clearly. Moshe Edel has an article on the idea of Rikuz Machshava within Kabbalah. Rikuz Machshava is the idea that one does it bodedut. One goes off into seclusion. One then focuses one's mind, Rikuz Machshava, and then one achieves some state of illumination, of Ha'ara, or Yichud through the process. Both of them are found in the philosophers and in the Kabbalists. Hold on. And that's important. This is not the dividing line between philosophers and Kabbalists. Bachya, Yehuda Halevi, the Rambam, and the Ralbag were all contemplatives. Even the Ralbag, the Aristotelian Gersonides, believed in Rikuz Machshava. They were contemplatives. As was, if we go to the Western secular case, Descartes started as a Jansenist contemplative, and that's why his book is called Meditations. Philosophy and meditation were linked in philosophy, in Western thought. So where we think they are set, for whatever reason, in a post 18th, 19th century world, we have separated out philosophy from contemplation. They made them the same. So that's out there, and all Kabbalists will assume the Bachya, Yehuda Halevi, Rambam as part of their just general Jewish background. Let me then give you two specific forms of Spanish Kabbalistic prayer. One of them the approach of Provence and Girona. The other one the approach of Castile. In Provence and Girona, one has a focus on the divine name, a Rikuz Machshava on the Shem Chavaya, explained in somewhat Maimonidean terms. Then one has a mental ascent up the spherotic chain. And depending on which Kabbalist we're talking about, whether you can get all the way up to Chochma Keter like Rav Israel of Girona, or like Yosef Chikatila, or others that will say you get up to Bina and no further. You make an ascent, And then when you make this mental ascent and have this mental screen in front of you, each word of the tefillot will have a specific sphera that you're thinking about. So I repeat the process. You have a somewhat maimonidean rikuz machshava on a divine name, even though he personally didn't do it. You then have an ascent using Re'uta Deliba with the somewhat Yehuda Halevi language up into the depths of the Sfirot. And then on each word of prayer, you are then visualizing in Yehuda, with Yehuda Halevi's Ein Sichle, a specific Sfira. Or in the language of the Shari Ora, you have to know which key to open up which door. The opposite approach, a different approach, are the Castilian Kabbalists. They will be interested in creating many gestures, many of those gestures going back to early Ashkenaz or Byzantium or earlier. They believe that there's a parallel between above and below, and you should be modeling yourself. For example, if the angels keep their feet together above, we keep our feet together below. If they raise themselves on their feet, we raise ourselves on their feet. And as a second part, the goal is to unify the Sfirot. And through this process of unifying the Sfirot, blessing will come down. So where in Girona and Provence you have a process of ascent and contemplation, in Castile you have a parallel world, a process of unifying the Sfirot through prayer, and then bringing down, a process of yichud, and then a bringing down of energies. Both of these Kabbalistic approaches are big defenders of the liturgy. They are very scrupulous in liturgy and exact performance of mitzvot. So unlike Bach's Chovot Levavot, in which liturgy does not play a big role in his explanation of tefillah, or even the Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim, in which liturgy does not play a big role in his explanation of contemplation, for the Kabbalists, every word of prayer is given incredible significance. For the Provence-Girona approach, the liturgy itself becomes a map of your meditations, while for the Castilians, the liturgy becomes a way to have a great effect on the universe. So unlike the popular idea from popular books on mysticism, in which mysticism is in some way against liturgy or against fixed religion, the 13th century Kabbalists are going to be very much into fixed what is. But then with the coming back of Chassidut from the Baal Shem Tov up to the Rebbe, will have that certain opening for there being higher states than the fixed liturgy. Yes? For these systems, the answer is no. 13th century systems do not have Bittul Hayesh. They assume you have nothing but a contemplative mind,
which you maintain throughout.
Which you maintain. It's a meditative, you've learned to empty your mind and have equanimity. Finish. You've practiced, you've gotten there, you know how to do it.
How much later is Avalokya?
Contemporary.
Is Avalokya is very into the fact that within prayer, whatever it is that you lose yourself.
Rebbe Lafayette does not talk about prayer.
Oh, okay. He's just prayer.
His these meditations are within prayer. Balafia, the phrase that Ezel uses, is anomic. He's outside of the law. Not against it, but outside. And then when Abulafia then gets quoted by the Ramak and others, they place it back within the liturgy. Okay, we will end here and continue next time on these topics.